Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Media Offensive, How the Press and Public Opinion Shaped Allied Strategy During World War II, by Alexander G. Lovelace, narrated by David DeVries. Series Editors Foreword, William A. Taylor. In The Media Offensive, How the Press and Public Opinion Shaped Allied Strategy During World War II, Alexander G. Lovelace explores the powerful, intricate, and significant links between the media and the military during World War II. Throughout this exceptionally fine book, Lovelace shows how the military employed media within the conflagration of total war and explores why the reasons for doing so varied, at times quite dramatically, ranging from improving resolve to deception operations. Lovelace establishes how once enjoined, the strong combination of the military and the media proved quite formidable, but also changed both partners in intriguing ways. Commanders sought to shape public opinion through the media, but military strategies often also morphed in response. In this innovative and pioneering work, Lovelace contributes to literature on the media during World War II by showing how the media, and by extension public opinion, affected the military in momentous ways, including vital choices on battlefields around the globe. Lovelace covers a striking array of examples, highlighting the essential partnership between the media and the military during World War II, including President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Germany First strategy, General Douglas MacArthur's exploits in the Southwest Pacific Area Theater, Lieutenant General Dwight D. Eisenhower's and Major General George S. Patton Jr.'s campaigns in North Africa and Sicily, Lieutenant General Mark W. Clark's actions in the Italian campaign, and the media's influence on an operation as large as D-Day, as well as throughout the final campaigns of World War II. Lovelace concludes his work by exploring the changing context of subsequent limited wars for the media-military relationship previously evidenced during total war. Along the way, Lovelace uncovers a series of crucial dichotomies in a democracy: media and military, public opinion and battlefield decisions, home front and front line, civilian and military, and national interest and international security. Lovelace expertly conveys a number of weighty themes that advance understanding of the media, the military, and the complex liaisons between them during World War II. He illustrates the ways in which the media and the military worked together to accomplish national goals during total war. In doing so, Lovelace adds a nuanced perspective on this vital affiliation, exhibiting how the media maintained its independence to be critical at times, revealing by what means the military sought to leverage accurate reporting for positive results, and exposing in what ways both entities recognized the value of even bad news. Among many noteworthy achievements, Lovelace clearly expounds how the United States used the media as one potent weapon in its arsenal during World War II. Lovelace discloses one of the major developments of this total war, emphasizing the media as a key component of military affairs. The media's newfound position and prominence reinforced information as a vital instrument of national power to be leveraged in combination with diplomatic, military, and economic capacity within coherent grand strategy. Lovelace grounds his cogent analysis in a most impressive plethora of archival research from dozens of manuscript collections located at 15 repositories across the country. Equally extraordinary, Lovelace integrates his extensive primary source research into the existing literature, displaying an outstanding command of both timeless classics and the newest research. The commendable result is a groundbreaking work that enhances comprehension of the multifaceted and complicated connections between the media and the military during World War II. Listeners interested in the subtle yet profound sway of the media on strategic decision-making during World War II will greatly profit from listening to this book. In addition, anyone drawn to the media, the military, total war, and many important intersections among them will find immense value in this deeply researched, lucidly written, and convincingly argued book that breaks much new ground on the ways in which the media proved both largely indispensable and highly instrumental during World War II. Introduction. World War II was a media war. A vast number of journalists chronicled the conflict in print, over the radio, or for motion pictures. They worked for small-town newspapers, major news corporations, military publications, or state-operated news outlets. Every military employed large staffs and organizations to facilitate and control news, propaganda, and public opinion. During the war, all major commanders of the U.S. Army had a public relations officer, or PRO, on its staff. World War II laid the groundwork for the ways that journalism, television, and social media are deployed as weapons in conflicts today. What truly made World War II a media war was the importance the military placed on the press and public opinion as weapons for total war. Most commanders thought accurate news reporting, as opposed to propaganda, would boost morale. Some believed the modern media could help them connect with their soldiers. Others hoped that the press could be used to attract public interest to their theater or campaign and force the Allied governments to allocate more resources to their missions. A few even used the press to deceive the enemy. To accomplish these objectives, military commanders began to allow the media and public opinion to influence their battlefield decisions. This was the case in Tunisia, Sicily, and Rome, during the breakout from Normandy, and on the advance into Germany. The media fueled disputes and jealousies, shaped George S. Patton Jr.'s race to Messina, Bernard Law Montgomery's advance into the Netherlands in the fall of 1944, and Omar Bradley's decisions during the Battle of the Bulge. Generals' media reputations influenced not only the command appointments of Dwight Eisenhower, Montgomery, and Patton, but even the creation of an entire theater for Douglas MacArthur. National prestige was also taken into consideration in inspiring the Doolittle Raid against Japan and its unintended consequences for the Pacific War, Eisenhower's sustained tolerance of Montgomery, and the decision to defend Strasbourg to save French morale. Media publicity is even at the root of why the Army and Navy now share the Pentagon building. Today, when most people get their knowledge of war from the mass media, it is generally assumed that news reporting and public opinion can influence military action. The Vietnam War is often cited as an example of a critical media turning public opinion against the war and causing the United States to lose the conflict. A host of books, however, including the U.S. Army's own study on reporting during Vietnam, has found no direct link between negative media coverage and public support for the war. As Daniel C. Hallin notes, historians have been essentially unanimous in rejecting the ideas that the media was decisive in turning the public and policymakers against the Vietnam War. Studies of the influence of cable news on policy and military decisions during the 1990s and 2000s, usually called the CNN effect, have produced no consensus on the influence of the media on military decisions. In any case, both Vietnam and the CNN effect dealt with television coverage and a much different media landscape than that which existed during World War II. Meanwhile, current scholarship on World War II journalism has largely overlooked the military-media relationship or any connection to the press's influence of military decision-making. Broadly speaking, historiography dealing with the media during World War II falls into three distinct groups. The first group chronicles the adventures of war correspondents. Although some are excellent in relaying what being a war correspondent was like, they seldom explain how reporters fit into the larger war or how their reporting influenced those they covered. The second group comprises studies that focus on propaganda. While this research focuses on the creation of policy and the effect of propaganda on friend and foe, propaganda cannot be classified as news. American reporters during World War II were generally careful to avoid being viewed as propagandists. The Allied militaries likewise maintained a sharp line between news and propaganda. Finally, there are a plethora of books on censorship, yet they tell only part of the story of how armies interact with the media. This book attempts to take scholarship in a different direction, an approach that could be called the new history of war reporting. Instead of focusing on how the military controlled the press through censorship and propaganda, this book instead demonstrates how the media influenced the military. A few other books take a similar approach and thus fall under the category of the new history of war reporting. Colonel Barney Oldfield's memoir, Never a Shot in Anger, relates the author's experience as a PRO in Europe. While the book is a treasure trove of information about the U.S. military-media relationship during World War II, it is still a personal memoir with inherent biases and limitations. Historian Richard W. Steele's The First Offensive, 1942, showed how public opinion shaped the decision to invade North Africa. Yet, Steele limited himself to one campaign and did not show that this was a larger trend. Stephen Casey's Cautious Crusade examines the role of public opinion on President Franklin D. Roosevelt's strategy against Nazi Germany. Though it is an excellent study, Casey limits himself to public opinion and focuses mostly on broad policy decisions of the Roosevelt administration instead of military action. Charles F. Brower examines the role of political influence on the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff in creating the strategy for the Pacific War. His book, Defeating Japan, finds the sensitivity of the Joint Chiefs to the link between the national will and strategic choice was perhaps the most essential element in their conduct of the war against Japan. Nevertheless, the book focuses solely on one theater of the war and discusses politics in general rather than the role of the media in shaping command decisions. The book that comes closest to answering these questions is Stephen Casey's The War Beat, Europe, which examines the exploits of an array of reporters along with their relationship to Allied generals and the PRO staff. But Casey's focus is still on the exploits of the war correspondents and not on how they influenced command decisions. Likewise, Nicholas Evan Sarantakis' article, Warriors of Word and Sword, shows how the media shaped command decisions during the Battle for Okinawa. P.M.H. Bell similarly wrote an article on how British public opinion on the Darlan deal influenced Allied strategy. Both Sarantakis and Bell, however, focused their analysis on only one episode. Therefore, the broader history of how the media and public opinion shaped Allied military decisions on the battlefield has yet to be published. Regarding broader themes in military history, this book does not fit into either the old military history, with its focus on battles, or the new military history's interest in the societal aspects of conflict. As in old military history, generals and battles crowd the pages. However, the focus is only enough to give the barest details of the fighting to support the larger argument. As in the new military history, this project takes seriously the idea that society and the home front can shape warfare, while never pretending that conflicts are decided any other way but through battle. Rather, through the conduit of the media, this book hopes to connect the civilian to the military, the home front to the battle front, and national interests to international action. It can thus best be described as a middle way between the old and new ways of studying war. This book traces how the military-media relationship shaped the battlefield decision-making of the U.S. military during World War II. It begins with a prologue briefly outlining how total war and the modern press evolved together and eventually merged during World War II. Chapter 1, which begins right after the attack on Pearl Harbor, shows how Roosevelt skillfully steered the press, public opinion, and his commanders into implementing the Germany First strategy. The second chapter conversely demonstrates what limitations public opinion placed on that commitment and how MacArthur successfully used the press to secure resources for the counteroffensive against Japan from the Southwest Pacific. Chapter 3 compares how Eisenhower and Patton attempted to utilize the press as a weapon, but soon found it shaping their decisions on the battlefield in North Africa and Sicily. Press influence reached a new level in the Italian campaign, during which, as the fourth chapter shows, General Mark Clark's desire to gain media glory dominated his actions in disastrous ways. Chapters 5 and 6 demonstrate how the media shaped D-Day and the final campaigns across Europe. The conclusion not only sums up the findings, but demonstrates how the military-media relationship from World War II transferred into later limited wars. Likewise, the conclusion highlights several themes that emerge from this research and how they fit into the larger scholarship on World War II. The first theme is how the military and the media merged to fight a total war. Although both sides kept their distinctive identities, prejudices, and institutions, this fusion can be seen in three areas. First, reporters covering the Allied armies became part of the military. They were inducted into the service, submitted to censorship, accreditation, and military discipline. Second, many former reporters took this a step further and joined the military not as war correspondents, but as staff officers. This group tended to be assigned as PROs and became an important conduit between the military and the media. Third, most of the highest-ranking generals in the Army had former reporters as staff officers. Their tasks often encompassed not only traditional military staff work, but also dealing with press relations. Given their literary abilities, these staff officers were later often major sources for the history of World War II. Thus, an important reason why the press was such an effective weapon for total war was the absorption of the media into the military. A closely related second theme is the importance of accreditation of reporters. Despite the amount of scholarship devoted to censorship, accreditation was at least as important for the military to control information and war correspondence. It was also mutually beneficial. Accreditation allowed reporters to be selected for special access, and fear of losing that license could coerce good behavior. At the same time, both American and British leadership felt freer to trust accredited war correspondents. Allied generals routinely brought reporters into their confidence, briefing them on coming battles, offering suggestions of where to find stories, and treating them as part of the military team. Of course, when you brief a bunch of correspondents, you are running the risk of a breach of security, Bradley recalled, but very little because the correspondents accredited to a combat zone are a very high-type bunch of people and patriotic people, and they don't let you down. Accreditation allowed the military more control over war correspondents, but provided accredited journalists with a vast amount of information. Despite accreditation and popular memories of the military-media relationship during World War II, an additional theme of this project is the recognition that the American press was hardly the unthinking supporter of the military or government. This is a fact overlooked in much of the scholarship on war reporting. One notable exception is historian Stephen Casey, who makes challenging this claim a central argument in The War Beat Europe. He concludes that the idea that the media and military were on the same side, the war reporters effectively acting as cheerleaders for the Allied cause, conceals more than it reveals. He adds that the more time reporters spent in the field, the less willing they became to side with the military and the more willing they became to follow their own opinions. Moreover, throughout World War II, there was a loyal opposition press in the United States, comprised of mostly Republican papers and usually centered in the Midwest. Indeed, the Democrats lost seats in the 1942 election, and Roosevelt's last presidential bid in 1944 was his closest presidential race. Likewise, the military and its leaders came under harsh press criticism during the war. The press attack on Eisenhower's alliance with former Vichy leaders in North Africa made him fear for his job. Patton was repeatedly criticized in the media to such an extent that several times he was almost relieved of command. The decision to focus on defeating Germany first instead of Japan was also debated freely in the media. Critical public and press opinion in a democracy during wartime was seen by many as a major weakness. It's one of the disadvantages of democracy that it can't conduct politics or war according to logic and intelligence, wrote Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, but have to respond to the up and down swings of public opinion. Some Allied leaders feared he was right. George C. Marshall worried that a democracy cannot fight a 7 years war, or more bitterly reflecting on strategy after the war, Marshall noted that we fail to see that the leader in a democracy has to keep the people entertained. Yet perhaps Marshall had little to worry about, given that some scholars conclude that government control over the press during wartime meant a media dominated by censorship. Truth, as Philip Knightley concluded, quoting Senator Hiram Johnson in his widely read History of War Correspondence, is the first casualty of war. Despite all this, a recurring theme throughout this book is not only that the media was useful as a weapon, but that its power was intricately connected to the truthfulness of information. Rather than attempt to create good morale by lying to their soldiers and countrymen with unadulterated propaganda, the U.S. military repeatedly discovered that the best effects resulted from accurate news stories. Thus, truthful news reporting, defined as news reporting that accurately depicts the events it described, could not be created by the military or even the media, but could only emerge by a free press searching for it. This, of course, is a challenge to the Nietzschean and postmodern ideas of truth as a relative exercise of power created by humans. As is seen throughout this book, the use of true information, as opposed to fake news, was viewed as having a power of its own. Even the Axis, whose leaders habitually lied to their subjects, were forced to be careful how much they exaggerated success or downplayed failure. Reich propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, a man not usually associated with truth, fretted about the need for frankness in propaganda. The new technology of long-distance radio transmissions was responsible for this increased honesty. The problem was particularly acute for Germany since the German people could easily obtain the BBC. Japan also recognized this reality. After the Japanese government admitted the loss of the midget sub-force used during the attack at Pearl Harbor, Admiral Matome Ogaki reasoned that, since the Washington press reported the story, Japan could not but announce it. Another example occurred later in the war. I listened to one of their Tokyo radio broadcasts, and it is comparatively conservative, wrote General Robert Eichelberger to his wife in the spring of 1944. Being directed at white listeners, I guess they try not to let it sound foolish, although, of course, they present an improper picture. Though the Western democracies were much more honest in their news, Axis broadcasts also forced them to loosen censorship. When the American government refused to release casualty figures, Stephen Casey observes, the Allied media turned to Axis radio figures with surprising frequency. As Chapter 2 demonstrates, Axis radio stations began broadcasting distorted information, which occasionally made the Allies respond by publishing accurate figures that might otherwise have been censored. Far from always pushing rosy news stories, commanders skilled in using the press as a weapon understood the usefulness of bad news. In his book on photograph censorship during World War II, George H. Roeder Jr. argues persuasively that to destroy American complacency about victory, the War Department released pictures of dead American soldiers that had been formerly censored. Casey makes a similar point, noting that Eisenhower loosened censorship because he feared the damage caused by overly optimistic war news. This book takes these observations a step further, and argues that overly optimistic news was a major concern for commanders after 1943. The War Department also held back bad news to provoke anger at an opportune moment. One example was delaying the news of the execution of the captured Doolittle Flyers. As indicated in Chapter 1 when the story was released, it sparked one of the largest war bond drives in U.S. history. Conversely, as Chapter 2 demonstrates, MacArthur desperately wanted the story of the Bataan Death March released because he believed it would cause additional resources to be sent to his theater. A critical press, an emphasis on truth when possible, and the understanding of the power of bad news paints a much more complicated picture of the military-media relationship than is often shown. Therefore, this book is a major revision to books such as Philip Knightley's The First Casualty, probably the most famous book on war correspondence ever published, that view reporters as lackeys of the military, and mostly a means of providing distorted propaganda to the masses. Truth may have been scarred, but reports of its death were greatly exaggerated. Another important theme is the media's ability to connect distant theaters in a global war. The concept of World War II as a global struggle with different theaters influencing each other is an idea highlighted by several historians. It was also well understood by Allied commanders. Asked in the late 1960s about the then prevailing historical consensus of the Atlantic and Pacific theaters as separate conflicts, General Bradley disagreed. It was the Germany First concept, Bradley believed, that united the conflict under a single strategy. What is missing from this historiography is the role of the press and public opinion in these international connections. First, as Chapter 1 demonstrates, facing pressure to retaliate against Japan after Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt deliberately created a press campaign to link Germany to Japan and build public support for a Germany First strategy. Although this was successful, Chapter 2 shows how it was also effectively challenged by Douglas MacArthur's own media campaign to supply the Southwest Pacific area with resources. Meanwhile, international tensions between the United States and her allies were often played out in the press. By the end of the war, which nation got credit for a battle was an important factor in strategy. How did commanders follow news about their battles? Certainly, most generals did not have easy access to stateside news. George C. Marshall, whose duties as Army Chief of Staff kept him near Washington, remembered that though he was not officially briefed on editorial opinion, he still read 9 newspapers a day. More typical was Eisenhower, who repeatedly claimed during the North African campaign that he did not receive American newspapers. But neither were they ignorant of current events. They could and did listen to the radio, particularly the BBC, and intelligence staffs sometimes prepared digests of stateside news coverage. Family members also sent newspaper clippings, as did superiors in the War Department. This lack of regular news highlights a larger finding of this book. Commanders often acted on what they thought news and public opinion might be, rather than first-hand knowledge. Therefore, the final theme of this book suggests that the lack of the morning paper did not stop generals from speculating what it might contain. What they perceived the news to be was more important than what the press actually said. The same was true of public opinion. At least one historian has written correctly that one still cannot claim to completely comprehend or define public opinion, but concluded incorrectly that during World War II, American leaders remained largely removed from the opinions of commentators and citizens. Scientific polling was still new but widely used, with results often appearing in the newspapers. Polls also appeared in intelligence reports prepared for President Roosevelt. Indeed, one important source for this book is the reports concerning news and editorial opinion provided by Archibald MacLeish at the Office of Facts and Figures. At the beginning of February 1942, MacLeish inquired whether the president would be interested in these reports. "I want all of them from the beginning," Roosevelt scribbled at the bottom of the letter. This project uses these scientific polling sources when they are available and appropriate. But as with newspaper opinion, it should be remembered that generals sometimes confuse.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?